An update now on our top story, the crash of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 today in eastern Ukraine. The plane was carrying 295 people, and reporters have seen bodies strewn on the ground in eastern Ukraine amid wreckage from the plane. The plane was traveling from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur. A Ukrainian official has claimed the plane was shot down. That has not yet been confirmed. We'll continue to follow this story and bring you the latest. But we go now to the big break this week in the dispute between China and Vietnam. China has decided to move an oil rig from the waters in the South China Sea that are claimed by both Beijing and Hanoi. There were violent anti-China protests in Vietnam after China deployed the rig in the disputed waters off the Paracel Islands in the South China Sea. And now China says it is shifting the location of the billion-dollar oil rig because its work in the area is done, not because of Vietnam's criticism. For more, we're joined by Murray Hebert, a Southeast Asia expert with the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Murray, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, is this dispute over?
No, I don't think so. It's been going on for a while. Likely will continue. So China, like you said, has announced that it's moving the oil rig. This, we don't know exactly why. Was it because of pending storms? China itself said it had completed two exploration tests. They were going to now take the data, analyze it. But this dispute really in the South China Sea has been with China and its the five other disputing countries has been going on for a long time, but it's really ramped up since 2009 or so, and so we can expect more to come.
Well, and give us a sense of the dispute here. This is Vietnam, which is a country that is really, its economy is growing very quickly. It's becoming a major manufacturing hub in Asia, a role that China has had and still does have. But tell us about the tension between these two countries, especially when it comes to energy exploration.
Well, yeah, the China claims basically all of the South China Sea. It's got a nine-dash line that basically goes around the outer rim of the South China Sea. China says it are its neighbors like Vietnam and the Philippines have been exploring for oil and gas within their it doesn't say within their continental shelf, but they have been exploring in disputed waters. They are in fact on Vietnam and the Philippines exclusive economic zone, which runs 200 nautical miles, and so China has been challenging this, and part of it is no doubt the need for all these countries that are growing so rapidly to find new sources of energy. But part of it is also China trying to assert its sovereignty over this very big South China Sea and basically claim it as its own lake.
Well, and we have some sound here from a spokesman for the Vietnamese Coast Guard recorded by the BBC. Here he is speaking through a translator.
We have fought through diplomatic, political and legal routes. We have tried to raise awareness of the issue in a peaceful manner. I think the Chinese have now realized this and so put an end to their infringement of our sovereignty.
So that's the official word from Vietnam. But did the U.S. play a role in this, do you think?
It probably played at least some role. The U.S. has been talking to all the parties and that are in this dispute in the South China Sea, and as well as recently as last weekend, when last Thursday and Friday, Secretary Kerry was in Beijing for the Strategic and Economic Dialogue, a dialogue that's held every year between the two countries. It raises a bunch of issues, but without a doubt, at the top of Kerry's concerns would have been the dispute in the South China Sea and would have probably urged China to find ways to tamp things down.
Murray Hebert, Deputy Director and Senior Fellow for Southeast Asia Studies at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Murray, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to the current conflict between Israel and Hamas. Rocket fire and airstrikes have resumed after a short-lived humanitarian ceasefire ended earlier today. The UN had asked both sides to pause fighting so that people in the Gaza Strip could get out to buy food and take care of essential business. NPR's Emily Harris joins us now from Gaza, where she's been for the past week. And Emily, what has it been like in Gaza today?
It's been quite different here in Gaza City, at least, than it has been the past week. After 10 a.m., after this humanitarian window ceasefire started, people began coming out of their homes, and the banks got big lines at them right away, people trying to withdraw their salaries, fighting over the ATM windows. At this one bank I went to, there was a long, long line and a bunch of guys at the front elbowing each other to get access to the buttons, and a group of nine women off to the side waiting their turn. Somebody might let them in. There were lines still at banks even after the humanitarian ceasefire window closed around 3. In shops, I went to a bakery where they had gone back to normal production of pita, producing the usual numbers of pita bread that they do, even though they had been cutting their production by half this week. People were out just to be outside, see other people. There was traffic for the first time in a week.
Now, yesterday, the first person killed in Israel during this fighting was buried. He was killed by a rocket from Gaza when he was distributing care packages to soldiers stationed along the Gazan border for a possible ground invasion. Across the border in Gaza, four young boys were killed on the beach. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I actually heard these strikes that killed these four boys. It happened just about a block away from where I was staying. And I've heard a lot of strikes in the past week. These were the loudest I'd heard yet. And so everyone who's staying here went downstairs, looked around, and found the spot it had hit. There were Palestinians, you know, running down there to the beach. Today we spoke to one of the boys, another cousin. These boys were cousins. And we spoke to another cousin who had been with them playing on the beach. And he said they were playing before the airstrikes hit. They were playing the version here of Cops and Robbers, which is Arabs and Jews. And they were dividing up who was who when the airstrikes hit.
Now, has any progress been made at all on the possibility of a full ceasefire?
Well, it seems there is work toward that. Progress is hard to measure. There are reports in the Israeli press and the Egyptian press of delegations from Hamas and from Israel in Cairo. There are reports of a ceasefire deal, although that's been denied by Israel's foreign minister. I spoke to representatives of Hamas and Islamic Jihad a few hours ago, and they said it seems that some progress is being made, but nothing was confirmed.
So what continue to be the main obstacles towards getting closer to a permanent ceasefire?
Israel is still debating internally what they want the result of this so far 9-day war to be. There's some talk of disarming Hamas, how that would be done. That's a big challenge. For one, Hamas is unlikely to agree to that. And the spokesperson with Islamic Jihad I spoke to today really laughed at that notion. And weapons are around here. They're deeply embedded here. Today, the United Nations actually announced that it had found rockets hidden in an empty storeroom in one of its schools. It said this is the first time it's discovered this type of activity in the Gaza Strip and was very outraged in its statement because the United Nations schools here are seen as a neutral sanctuary. On the Palestinian side, the militant factions here in Gaza have a range of political demands. The primary one is access to the outside world. That would likely come through Egypt, travel for people who live here, and a greater flow of commercial goods. They also are asking for the release of Palestinian prisoners, and they want elections to be held in the Palestinian territories to get Palestinians back to one government and end this more than 7-year divide between Hamas ruling Gaza and Fatah in the West Bank.
Now, Emily, and during every single day of this current conflict, there's been a major lingering question about whether or not Israel will choose to launch a ground invasion into Gaza. Today, what are the chances of that?
I would say it's still an option, certainly. The question is whether a ground invasion would bring about the results that Israel wants. What the result, the end result should be, is being debated within Israel. And the risk to a ground invasion is a higher cost for Israel in money, certainly in time, in potentially Israeli lives. The question that is at the center of the Israeli debate around this is, what difference could a ground invasion make?
NPR's Emily Harris reporting from Gaza. Thank you, Emily.
Thank you.
Now, there have been photos published around the world of the site where those four boys in Gaza were killed. We had an amazing conversation with the New York Times' Tyler Hicks, who took some of those photographs. You can see the pictures and listen to that conversation at our website, hereandnow.org.
We're going to take a step back from today's news right now to continue our conversation about miscarriages. Yesterday, we spoke with Dr. Michael Green, an expert in obstetrics, about miscarriages and why they happen and how prevalent they are. Today, we want to hear from a woman who has had several miscarriages, and we want to note that this conversation may not be suitable for all ears. Karen Gibbons is a mother of two. She's from Stoughton, Massachusetts, and joins us now. And Karen, you had two miscarriages before your first child was born. For those first two pregnancies, which happened, the miscarriages happened early on in the pregnancy, did you tell anyone you were expecting?
For the first two miscarriages, the first two pregnancies, we didn't tell anyone. A lot of friends that I knew, they always talked about like, oh, you wait until you're in past the first trimester to tell people just in case something happens. So we did the same thing. We said, let's not tell anyone. We'll wait until after we're past the first trimester just in case something happens, not really thinking anything's going to happen. The problem with doing that for me was that when we did lose the pregnancies, we had no support system in play. There was no one knew what we were going through. And I had really, other than my husband, I didn't have anyone to turn to. And that was difficult because I would sometimes just burst into tears to what other people saw as no reason. You know, I would, or somebody would tell me that they were pregnant and I'd have to leave the room because I could feel the tears starting. Hmm. So that was difficult, putting yourself in that position with no support system.
But with the third pregnancy,
correct,
in 2005,
yes,
you did tell people from the start.
We found out we were pregnant in February of 2005. And yes, immediately we told our family, our friends. I told my husband actually still wanted to wait. And I told him, I can't. I need to have people know what this is, what's going on. I need people to know this because if something goes wrong this time, I need to have friends and family around us to support us through this. And we were fortunate because this pregnancy went on to give us a beautiful son.
And what was that like to after going through these two miscarriages, mm-hmm, to finally pass the point where you'd had the miscarriage,
yes,
before and realize that at least up until that point, the pregnancy was still a go?
Prior to getting to the 10 weeks where I had miscarried before, I was terrified. Every single cramp I had, every little twinge, you immediately start going, am I going to miscarry again? I didn't have morning sickness at all, which to most women would be a blessing. But for me, it felt like one more thing that was telling me, is there something wrong? Why don't I have morning sickness? Is it because, you know, there's something wrong with the pregnancy? We did find that once we got past that point, the 10-week mark, we started to relax a little bit. And then when we saw the heartbeat for the first time on an ultrasound, that really kind of gave us a lot more comfort. And then I allowed myself to enjoy the pregnancy, and it was the best experience of my life.
And you had your son, Neil, who is now 8 years old. And then you tried to get pregnant again.
We did. We decided to start trying to get pregnant again almost immediately after Neil was born. And it took a couple of years before we did get pregnant with a second child. And it was 2007. And unfortunately, once again, at 6 weeks, I miscarried that pregnancy.
So after that miscarriage, mm-hmm, you then got pregnant again?
Yes. This time we got pregnant. It was 2009, so 2 years later. We got pregnant again, and that pregnancy resulted in my wonderful son, John.
Who's now 4 years old.
He is now four, yeah. That was a stressful pregnancy, one, because, again, you have those fears of having another miscarriage. Also, the miscarriage that I had in 2007 had created a lot of complications. I ended up having to have three procedures called a DNC, dilation curettage, where the doctor would go in and remove the contents of the uterus, and I had to have that done three times, and that caused a lot of issues. So the whole pregnancy with my second son was a high-risk pregnancy, so they were watching me very carefully. That, in one way, though, that was actually a comfort because I was getting ultrasounds constantly and seeing that I had a healthy baby growing there. So,
now, I imagine there are some women listening to this who are surprised that they're hearing all of this because very often, women just don't talk about this kind of thing. You don't hear the stories of miscarriages, mm-hmm, which may be why many people get so concerned when they have a miscarriage, because they're worried that this is happening to them and it's not as common as it is.
That is so true. It is still, after all these years, it's still considered such a taboo topic. People don't talk about it when they have miscarriages. And so you feel alone. You're going through this grieving and you don't feel – you feel like you're the only one that's going through that, or that you're the only one that's been through it. And what ends up happening is when you do start to tell your story, you start to realize how many other people have gone through it. It's amazing how many people, when I did tell my story, I would hear, oh, we did too. You know, we had one before our child, or we had multiple miscarriages, or my mom had them, or, you know, it just – there's so many women, because it is. It's very, very common. One thing that I did do after the miscarriage in 2007 was I – before I could even begin to try again, I knew that I just needed to get some help. I had my support system of friends and family, but I needed more than that. So I went looking for a support group. And they do exist. I found a wonderful support group for perinatal loss. So it covered miscarriages or pregnancy losses later in the pregnancy as well. And I really got a lot of support from that. One of the things that the moderator had always said was, there's healing in telling your story. And I find that that's very true. The more you tell your story and tell people what's happened to you, the more you start to feel some healing.
Well, why do you think so many women don't tell that story then?
I think partly because it's the kind of loss that you can't see. When you lose, say, a parent, you know, people knew that parent. It was a person. Or if you lost your child, it's a person. But a lot of times, I think some people don't see a miscarriage as really being a person. You never saw the baby. You never were able to hold your baby. The grief that you feel can be very strong. You feel like you lost your child. You have lost your child, but because the attitudes that you see out there, the doctors that tell you to be grateful because you were only miscarried at 10 weeks, or the people who question why you're so upset because you never got to hold that baby, it makes you feel like you really shouldn't be grieving that much.
You not only went on to have a couple of kids after this whole experience, but you also started a new career. Tell us about that.
I did. During this time when I was going through all this, I actually was working as an actuarial analyst in insurance. And when I was going through all of the miscarriages and as well as going through the births of my sons, I encountered so many nurses that just provided me with so much compassionate care that really let me talk about what I was going through and just let me have my tears and let me grieve. And I wanted to then go on and provide that to other patients.
Do that for others.
Yes, exactly.
And what will you tell women who do have miscarriages in your capacity as a nurse?
If I'm fortunate enough to work in that field, I will tell them that they should allow themselves to grieve. Don't let anyone set a timeline for you. Don't let anyone tell you that you don't have the right to grieve. This was your child. This was your hopes and your dreams. And you have every right to grieve that and to allow yourself to feel that. I would encourage them to also, you know, make sure they have a support system in place. Make sure they have friends and family that can support them. I would encourage them to consider looking into a support group, because there is healing in telling your story.
Karen Gibbons, who's been sharing her story of having a number of miscarriages, but also two sons, 8-year-old Neil and 4-year-old John, doing well, and Karen on her way to becoming a nurse. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
And if you missed yesterday's conversation with the chief of obstetrics at Massachusetts General Hospital, it's at hereandnow.org. Today, Microsoft announced that it's cutting 18,000 jobs over the next year. That's 14% of the company's workforce, the largest jobs cut in Microsoft history. Ina Fried is senior editor at Recode and joins us now from San Francisco with more on this. Ina, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us what Microsoft is up to here. Why so many layoffs?
Well, a huge chunk of these 18,000 cuts, 12,500 of them, are coming from the Nokia business. Microsoft, as you recall, bought the phone business of Nokia in a deal that closed in April. But a significant chunk are coming from within Microsoft's traditional rank and file as well.
And if so many are coming from Nokia, does that mean that a lot of these cuts are going to be overseas jobs?
There are going to be quite a bit. So a lot of them are coming from both the places where Nokia phones are designed, so a lot in Finland, as well as some of the places where they're built. So a lot of cuts there, but also cuts in traditional Microsoft places. So obviously the Seattle area, as well as the Bay Area, where Microsoft is a significant employer.
Well, and we see that Microsoft says it's no longer going to make Nokia phones based on the Android operating system. What does this say about Microsoft's phone business?
So I think Microsoft here is saying, look, we have to concentrate. We want Windows Phone to be successful. And if we're going to do that, we can't also be building for Android. These aren't Google Android phones. These are based on the open source part of Android, and they were running Microsoft and Nokia services. So there was some logic to Microsoft keeping this. At the same time, it was spreading itself a little bit thin.
You know, what does this tell you about where Satya Nadella, the new CEO of Microsoft, wants to take the company?
I think one thing that he's clearly trying to show is that he can move quickly. I think if anything, you can't say he didn't move fast and decisively. He's only been CEO since earlier this year. The Nokia deal just closed, and he's already making significant cuts. The question is, will this drive the culture shift that he's talking about? Are they cutting in the right places, and are they replacing what's missing with a culture that really can move quicker?
Well, and who are the main competitors to Microsoft right now, and how do they do in that space?
Well, I mean, in different areas, it's different companies, but Google is probably tops on that list in most of those areas. So in phones, it's Android and iPhone. In computers, it's really Google and Chromebooks versus traditional Windows PCs. You know, in the server world, they compete with a lot of the big business companies, so IBM, Oracle. Microsoft still has a long list of competitors. It's an oldie in the tech world. And Salesforce.com, only a few years old, born in the internet era. So it is time for Microsoft to change the way it does business.
And change the culture, you're saying, and become what, more like Google?
I think in some ways more like Google, and in some ways more like Apple, and in some ways just more like a Microsoft for the modern era. And I know that's a little corny, but really, Microsoft isn't going to win here by becoming Google or becoming Apple. They have to find a way to take what they're good at and modernize it.
You know, one of the things that is upsetting to a lot of people as they look at this news, terrible news, 18,000 jobs, at least for the people whose jobs are being lost, that when that gets announced, as happened this morning, the stock of Microsoft ends up going up.
Yeah, it's one of those cruel things about the business world is there's very little Wall Street likes better than job cuts. And, you know, in part it's because it's really hard to predict future growth, and it's really easy to see how cost savings affect the bottom line. But it is always one of those sick realities when you look at it, and you know it. And I, you know, told my editors, the news came out at 5 our time this morning. I said, you know, I'm going back to bed, but pay attention at 6 when the market opens, and I bet there's a huge bump.
Ina Fried, senior editor at Recode, joining us from San Francisco. Ina, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
If you had to guess how many Americans don't have a basic bank account, what number would you guess? A couple million? Well, how about more like approximately 70 million? As The Atlantic's Derek Thompson writes, that's more people than live in California, New York, and Maryland combined, more people than voted for Barack Obama or Mitt Romney in the 2012 presidential election. That's 70 million Americans who do not have access to traditional banking services. And for them, being poor means that money itself is expensive. Derek Thompson joins us now from NPR in New York to explain. Hi there, Derek.
Hi there.
So what do we mean when we say money itself is expensive for people who don't have access to traditional banking?
The first thing to say is that that 70 million number applies not only to people who don't have a bank account, that's I think a little bit lower, but also people who don't have access to the kind of traditional banking services that a lot of other Americans sort of take for granted. And if it's okay, I'll sort of start by talking about my own experience, which I don't think is unusual, and I think it's probably the experience of most people listening on this show. You know, I have a bank account, I have direct deposits, I have automatic payments, I can easily transfer money from my bank account to other people's accounts, I can do it on my phone. My balance is 2 clicks and a password away. You know, making money is hard, but banking isn't so hard. But there's millions of people who have none of this. Instead of a direct deposit, they rely on physical pay stubs. Instead of checking accounts, they have to drive to check cashing services like Pay-O-Matic, which cost money. Instead of automatic payments, they have to drive again across the suburbs to pay their utility bills in person. So replacing the services of a bank on your own becomes a second part-time job, really. It's an odyssey that takes you through these storefronts and these strip malls and prepaid cars and miles on the road.
Right. So not only is there just the direct cost in terms of all the fees associated with using these alternative financial services, but there's the cost in terms of your time. And this issue is at the heart of a new documentary that you write about in The Atlantic. It's called Spent, Looking for Change. It was produced by American Express and aired at the Aspen Ideas Festival in June, and it profiles a number of people who have to go through this financial odyssey, as you call it. And one of them is this couple, Alex and Melissa, who were doing pretty well until Alex was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis and had to quit his job. And in the documentary, we see how having to live on cash has had an impact on Melissa and Alex's day-to-day life, such as you said, Melissa has to drive to different places to pay the bill. So let's listen.
On payday, it's getting to the places so I can get the bills paid on time.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. I'm here to pay the power.
So Melissa says also that she has to use, a quarter of to a half a tank of gas just driving around paying bills each month. That only adds to the cost of essentially being poor.
Right. Melissa and Alex are a really interesting and tragic story, because here you have a two-income household that was beset by sequential tragedies. You had Alex, the husband, diagnosed with MS. Within a few weeks, their son was diagnosed with rather severe autism, and it requires a lot of money in order to treat these medical problems. These are two people that didn't make any capital M mistakes. It was circumstances beyond their control that pushed them to desperation. And so now they rely on cash. And as a result, they have to spend half of their day driving around and making sure that everything is being paid on time as much as possible. Mm-hmm. One of the saddest things that I saw in the case of Melissa and Alex is they visited a payday lender. They had to get a $450 loan. It says later at the end of the documentary that they paid $1,700 in fees on that $450 loan, $1,700, before their neighbors bailed them out. So these are sort of the cycles of negative reinforcement that happens when you're forced to cobble a life together outside of the traditional banking system.
Right. And you write in your piece in The Atlantic that this kind of goes against one of the fundamental principles of progressive economics, as you call it, that basically in the United States, we have so many services that are designed to make life for poor Americans easier and cheaper. I mean, you mentioned there's Medicaid for medical care, food stamps for food, families with children can receive tax credits, et cetera. But we haven't seen that same push to make life easier and cheaper when it comes to financial services. Why not?
It truly does seem backward. It seems like we have built this entire apparatus from the federal government standpoint that says life should be easier if you're poor. We have enough money to build a progressive system that can help you out if you aren't fortunate enough to make a lot of money. But just as you said, the banking system seems to be the opposite. It is more expensive to be poor. And that just to me strikes me as somewhat grossly unfair, and which is why I was really excited to see the documentary and learn a little bit more about some of the services that are being created in order to help these people create a banking-type experience online.
Right. And I'm going to talk to you about that in a second. But I also note, I mean, you just have so many great and disturbing facts in your piece that unbanked families spend 10% of their money replacing traditional banking services. That's as much as most families spend on food. I mean, it's just remarkable to hear those numbers presented so plainly. But Derek, let me ask you, I mean, this documentary that we're talking about was produced by American Express, the credit company, the credit card company. I mean, it would seem that seems a little strange to me, because don't you think they're in the business of trying to get people like to get in more credit, and they maybe don't want necessarily folks to go to traditional banking services.
True. That's a really good point. I mean, I think you're right. We should totally be upfront about the fact that this is a documentary produced by a company that is in the finance industry. You know, American Express has its own services, its own apps that directly try to help unbanked Americans approximate some of the functions of a banking system so that they can, you know, they can take money online, have it on their phone, use it to make automatic payments. A lot of the things that we take for granted if we belong to a Wells Fargo or a Bank of America. One of the things that you find when you sort of go into this issue is that the Wells Fargos and the Banks of America are closing branches in parts of the country that have a lot of low-income Americans. And so there just aren't a lot of bank branches there. And so you have a very tenuous grasp on these low-income families who are just entirely outside of the traditional banking system. We have the technological tools, essentially, to replace a lot of these services on our smartphones because we don't have to drive to our smartphones. They're always on our bodies. So if we can find ways to have apps and have technological solutions to this banking problem, I think it could be a really wonderful thing.
Derek Thompson writes about unbanked Americans in The Atlantic. Derek, thanks so much.
Thank you.
In Beijing today, the air quality index is squarely in the very unhealthy zone, according to the U.S. Embassy's readings there. And that is not all that unusual. The intense smog means that companies are increasingly considering Beijing a hardship post. Coca-Cola is one of the latest to start giving expat employees there a bonus for environmental hardship, an extra 15% of their salary. NPR's Anthony Kuhn is with us now from Beijing. Hi there, Anthony.
Hi, Meghna.
So we just read what the latest air quality index reading is from the U.S. Embassy in the very unhealthy zone. What does that actually mean, looking out the window? What does it feel like?
Okay, well, it is visible. You can look out the window. You can see this haziness. It is not the worst, okay? We're in the 220s today. Air quality index is in the 220s. Healthy is under 25. When it gets over, I don't know, 300, 500, something like that, it bites. It stings your eyes, your throat. It's really uncomfortable. It makes you cough. And you know in the long term, it's shaving years off your life.
Huh.
So it's not imperceptible at all.
Wow. Actually, the way you describe it, it sounds like a major issue, which is why, no surprise, Coca-Cola has become one of the latest companies to label Beijing a hardship post. Apparently, Panasonic did the same thing in March. The State Department even offers a 15% bonus to foreign service officers there. For major international companies, is this becoming the norm?
No, hardship pay is not yet the norm for Beijing. It's heading in that direction. What I would say is that concern is the norm about this. Of course, every time we talk about the subject, you get a big wind, it clears it out, and the skies are beautiful blue and the sun is blazing. And there's been quite a bit of that this summer. But I think for everyone who lives there, it really is a concern. It's just a matter of how much you can do about it. And expatriates tend to be better equipped to do something about it than other people. They have a choice about whether to live in it or pick up and move.
Mm. So I don't know if you've spoken to people who have been posted to Beijing and are maybe getting offered this extra hardship pay. Is 15% enough to keep people there or to even entice them to take the posting to begin with?
Well, I think it certainly makes a difference. It's certainly a step in the right direction. I mean, just practically speaking, it will help you to afford, for example, imported air purifiers and face masks. You know, when the air quality index is in the hundreds, you'd want to use those. You know, it's a tough professional decision. It depends on whether you have kids. It depends what your line of work is. But there's this contradiction that increasingly Beijing is the place to be for a lot of professions because so much is happening here. So much of the world's economy, so much of the world's, you know, creative forces here in every field you can imagine. In a lot of ways, it's hard not to be here, but in many ways, transportation and the environment are just raising the cost for everybody.
Now, with that raising of the cost, I mean, is it having a measurable impact on China economically or for foreign companies who are choosing to do business in China?
Well, it's been well documented that people are dying prematurely because of air pollution. Lung and respiratory diseases are way up. And China may have saved money earlier in manufacturing processes, but they're paying the cost later down the road in terms of health. Now, you know, how many people are moving because of this? We don't have figures on that. Anecdotally, I can tell you that I know a lot of people who are well-educated. They're thinking about their kids' futures, their kids' health, their kids' education, and a lot of them are voting with their feet. They're leaving, and that is definitely costing everybody here.
NPR's Beijing correspondent Anthony Kuhn. And Anthony, we'll give you a second to put your face mask back on before we send you back outside.
Much appreciated. Thank you, Meghna.
A Malaysia Airlines plane carrying 295 people appears to have crashed in eastern Ukraine near the border with Russia. Flight 17 was traveling from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur. A Ukrainian official is saying the plane was shot down. That has not yet been confirmed. But Malaysia Airlines has confirmed on Twitter that it lost contact with one of its flights over Ukrainian airspace. For the latest, we turn now to NPR international correspondent Corey Flintoff, who is in Moscow. And Corey, what do we know at this point about what happened?
Well, the only thing that we know with any certainty is that there has actually been a catastrophic passenger airline crash in eastern Ukraine, because we're now getting eyewitnesses' accounts from the scene. Emergency officials and a Reuters wire service reporter are there, and they say that they do see the burning wreckage of a big passenger jet. The debris seems to have the colors of Malaysian Airlines on it, and they say that they're seeing a large number of bodies, at least 100, around the scene. They do say, though, that the debris field around the wreckage is something like 9 miles in diameter, so it's going to be very difficult to find any people, any survivors, anything that could tell us very much about what brought this plane down.
Well, and as we said, there's this Ukrainian official who is saying that it was shot down. The Ukrainian president has denied shooting at any airborne targets. The separatist rebels there are saying that they did not shoot down the plane, although neither have offered evidence at this point. What can we trust here, Corey?
Well, practically nothing. I mean, this is a conflict zone in eastern Ukraine. At the moment, they say the area where the plane went down is actually under the control of the pro-Russian separatists. But these two sides have been conducting a propaganda war, and frankly, both sides have been lying about things that happened here. Each side is accusing the other of shooting at civilians and that kind of thing. In this case, spokespeople from both sides have accused the other of using these missiles to shoot down the plane. So we have no idea whether there's any truth to any of this. One of the reasons why this is a fairly fraught subject, though, is that Ukraine has been accusing Russia of providing these kinds of armaments to the pro-Russian separatists. And in fact, yesterday, Ukrainian officials said that a Russian plane shot down a Ukrainian fighter jet with an air-to-air missile. So in that case, it was an allegation that the Russians are now fighting directly in this war.
NPR international correspondent Corey Flintoff joining us from Moscow with the latest on Malaysia Airlines Flight 17, which apparently has crashed in eastern Ukraine. Corey, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And for more, let's bring in Jim Walsh now, security expert at MIT Security Studies Program. Jim, what are you seeing in all of this?
Well, Jeremy, it's hard to think that this is a coincidence, that this plane, you know, planes rarely go down. When you look at the number of planes that come down, given all the flights that there are, it's a pretty rare event. Could it be weather? Could it be malfunction? Could it be terrorism? You know, we went through all this with that Malaysian flight before, but over an active war zone in which a plane was shot down on Monday, an air transport at, you know, not quite the same height, but in that neighborhood, and then another plane being shot down, alleged to have been shot down yesterday. You know, Occam's razor would tell you to go with the simplest explanation, and it would seem like this would be related to the conflict.
What would be the benefit of shooting down a passenger plane, though, for either side?
Well, certainly for the Ukrainian rebels and for the Russians, no benefit whatsoever. This will certainly reframe the politics of that debate. You know, Putin had managed the PR and propaganda piece pretty well up to now, but this certainly would switch that. You know, Ukraine, the Ukrainian government, we have to say, benefits from this outcome if, it, in fact, the Russians or Ukrainian rebels are seen to have essentially murdered 300 civilian passengers.
And we should, of course, remind you mentioned the previous Malaysia Airlines plane that went missing back in March. That was Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. This is Malaysia Airlines Flight 17. but not good for that airline either.
I can hardly believe it. I mean, they have to have – this has to be the worst year of any airline, you know, all time for them. And we'll see. I think Corey was right to emphasize we don't have all the facts. The facts that we have are going to change. That's how these stories unfold over time. But I think we will know what happened. My guess is that Intel people in the U.S. government and in Europe already know what's happened, and we have the wreckage. That's the one thing we have with this flight that we didn't have with the other flight is we have the wreckage. So
we have images of the wreckage right now is what we're already seeing on television and on Twitter. There are pictures of large pieces of debris that appear to be with the paint that would be on a Malaysia Airlines plane. We've got Malaysia Airlines saying that it did lose contact with this plane. We've got a video now that appears to show smoke rising from this area in eastern Ukraine. And we've got Ukrainian officials saying we didn't have anything to do with this.
Yeah, and I would discount any statement by any of the parties that are involved in the conflict. I wouldn't follow what they say. But the deal is the evidence will speak for itself. You know, whoever gets to that plane first and secures the physical evidence, if a missile tore through it, we're going to see that. If there's explosive residue on the wreckage, we're going to see that. And what's more, I think U.S., European, and other countries, their intel communities have been watching this area, right? I'm sure there are satellites pointed right at this, trying to figure out what's going on. If something happened within that space, they saw it.
But who has the ability to get there first? In this contested area.
Yeah, and I don't know the answer to that question, but I can assure you that everyone is rushing towards it right now.
All right, Jim Walsh from MIT Security Studies Program, bringing us up to date on what we know at this point about a Malaysia Airlines plane that was carrying 295 people, apparently has crashed in eastern Ukraine near the border with Russia. It was traveling from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur, and this Ukrainian official saying the plane was shot down. We will have to see if that turns out to be true. We haven't confirmed that yet. Jim Walsh, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.